Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey, and my name is Dick. You'll also hear Kilo 2, Kilo Echo Yankee. His name is Mel. Mel and Dick attempt to be the net control hosts of the technical net, in which the enthusiastic guys in the New York City area, including northeastern New Jersey, southwestern Connecticut, southern New York, we get together and discuss our favorite subject, ham radio. We claim this is the new improved. We make a promise that we try very hard during the first hour to answer everyone's question at least briefly. In other words, you'll get some kind of an answer. You're not going to have to wait more than an hour. Beyond the first hour, Mel opens his mailbag at approximately 9 o'clock so that we can answer the questions from the younger people that are about to get their ham radio license. Some of them have listened to the TechNet, decided that you guys are having a lot of fun and they want to join it. So they go out and get their ham license. And they send sometimes as many as 300 emails to Mel. I don't know how he can handle it all. He must be quite heroic. The main purpose of the technical net is to try to educate ourselves. Quite often a person has a question on one of the 25 or 26 different kinds of ham radio. Let me drop. They want to understand the rules and regulations, the laws of physics, how do transmitters and receivers and antennas and transmission lines and propagation, how does all this stuff work? That's the usual questions for the technical net. And when somebody asks a question, quite often there's a fair amount of experience in the brain power that exists in the New York City area. Somebody hears that and it gives us the benefit of his wisdom. So it's a group gathering. It's a self-education type organization, unofficial. Been around for, let me think now, 1982 to now, it's 28 years, I believe. 28 and a fraction years. This is TechNet number 1,341, approximately, of the series that began in September of 1982. As long as Mel and I stay healthy, we intend to continue. We seem to have hit on a good thing here. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. After 28 years, we don't need 50 people signing in saying that they're listening. By now, we sort of assume that after all these years. Try to remember to give me your name, because I'm so darn forgetful. K2RIW listening, give me your call letters and name and that word yes right now.
KC2RFN, yes, Alan.
N2MB, yes, Barry.
Or JCP, Dale, yes. Okay, so far I've gotten Alan, Barry, and Dale. Dale, there was a double when you signed in, so please give me your call letters again.
Kilo, Juliet 4, Juliet, Charlie, Papa. Dale, via Echo Link, Lubbock, Kentucky.
Very fantastic. Hey, Dale, one of the brave guys from Kentucky, out of the area. Kilo, Juliet 4, Juliet, Charlie, Papa, I think if I got it right. Okay, we've got Alan, Barry, and Dale. Anyone else? Give me your call letters at this time and name.
Good evening, K2, K-E-Y.
And there's our co-host, Mel. And one last call. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet with a question or a comment, please give me your call letters and name right now.
KC2WGB, John, yes.
Hey, you and Wesley are a given. Okay. Let's start off with Alan. Haven't heard from you with a question for a couple of weeks, Alan. Alan's the man who put the TechNet up for the national award, which it won a couple of months ago. KC2RFN. You got it, Alan? K2RIW.
KC2RFN, and good evening, Dick and Mel. Yeah, I haven't had to ask questions because there's been everybody else asking great questions, so I was able to just listen. But I do have a question that came up, and I don't know if it's simple or not, but I had a mobile antenna, 2 meter 440, on my car, which had a mount that I screwed into the lid of the trunk, and we scraped a little of the paint so that the little screws could dig in there and make a good ground. But when I got another car, it was a little higher, so I had to get a different mount that would allow the antenna to rotate down. And I actually used a little electrical device that is a motor that allows it to swing up and down. Now, the interesting thing here is that this new device does not have any direct grounding. In fact, there's a rubber strap that is between the motorized unit and the car, the rail of the car that I have it linked up to. Let me just drop for a second. Now, unlike the first installation I had with my other car, there is now no direct ground between that mount and the car. The only way I can see the antennas getting grounded through the shield of the coax, which goes to the rig itself, which then is, of course, grounded to the body of the car. But the way I'm viewing it, though, is that it seems that this configuration does not have a ground plane. So in the old configuration with the other car, the body of the car acts like a ground plane, and then I got the vertical coming off of that. But and even in a vertical antenna situation at someone's home, you'll have radials that will act as a ground plane even if it's high up off the ground. But here I have basically a plastic mount with rubber interfacing between the mount and the metal of the car. So now it seems to me that there is no direct ground plane, and yet it seems to be working fine. So I'm wondering, Dick, what area or theory of antennas am I not getting here that's allowing this configuration to work? Over to you, Dick, KC2RFM.
K6DPZ with a comment.
Hal recognized. Are you familiar with this particular antenna, Hal?
A feeling it's instead half wave. It's being driven. You don't need a counterpoise.
Now, that's a very simplistic way of putting it, but I think I agree with you. Before I proceed, Alan, roughly how long is the antenna? Roughly how long is the antenna, and does it contain any loading coils that you can see? Over to you, Alan.
The antenna is about 3 feet long, and it has the antenna itself in the middle. The rod has been twisted into about four coils before it continues up vertically, and that coil is right in the center of the rod.
Okay, you said some magic words there, and I think Hal hit it on the head, and that is when you build a quarter wave antenna. And I'm going to first backtrack and tell you what a half-wave antenna is. An ordinary half-wave dipole, usually it's a half-wave long. Right-hand side, you drive positive. Left-hand side, you drive negative during one particular instant of time. And the next half-wave, you do the opposite. That kind of an antenna is a thoroughly balanced structure, requires no ground of any kind. In fact, it works better the further it is away from ground. If you put a sheet of metal, and I know a lot of you guys have heard this one already, but some of them who haven't, maybe you'll benefit from it. So stand by for a minute or two. If you put a sheet of metal normal to the dipole at right angles to it, right in the center, because the right-hand side is at one instant positive, the left-hand side is negative of the dipole, there is a neutral plane down the center where you put the sheet of metal. So putting a sheet of metal there does nothing. Doesn't change the pattern, doesn't change the impedance, doesn't change the gain, nothing changes. Then if you decide to feed the right-hand side of the dipole with reference to that sheet of metal, and you throw away the left-hand side of the dipole, except for the fact that your 70 ohms goes down to 35 ohms, that's a pretty good antenna. And the other half of the dipole is there as the mirror image in that sheet of metal. But now the sheet of metal, in theory, should be nice and large to act as the counterpoise, the thing that you're pushing the current from and to. Ordinarily, when you've got a thoroughly balanced dipole, what your transmission line and transmitter is doing is at one half of the cycle, let me drop, on the full half-wave dipole, at one half of the cycle, it is sucking electrons out of the left-hand side of the dipole and pumping them into the right-hand side. That's what a full half-wave dipole does. When you throw away half of the dipole and you make a ground plane, you're now pumping electrons out. You're pumping electrons out of the sheet of metal into the quarter wave of dipole that's left. And so the sheet of metal counts a lot. So electronically, if you make the dipole a half, if you make the radiator a half wave long, and there's nothing magic about feeding a dipole-like antenna in the center, if you're smart enough and you got the right kind of dialing device, you can feed it in the center, 10% off from the center, 50% off from the center, all the way out to the outer edge. The main thing that changes when you change the place and the dipole where you feed it is that in the center it's got something like 72 ohms of impedance, and as you go out to the outer edge, the impedance becomes something like 1,500 ohms, a very high impedance. And if you decide to feed a full half-wave dipole without putting a center insulator, you just make it a half-wave of wire, so to speak, and you feed one end, you're feeding a 1,500 or 2,000 ohm impedance. In that case, an extremely small counterpoise, in fact, essentially no counterpoise at all, works, because you're now sucking very little current out of the counterpoise, so to speak. You're feeding an extremely high impedance, and all that resonant energy is bouncing back and forth in that dipole. A quarter-wave antenna on 2 meters is 19 inches long. If I double that, it's 38 inches. That's almost 3 feet. The fact that your antenna is essentially 3 feet long tells me that mechanically it's essentially a half wave, and with and without those loading coils, electronically it is half wave. As such, all it needs is a couple of picofarads between the base that you're feeding and what it thinks is ground plane, which is the nearest chunk of sheet metal that's...
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
The nearest chunk of sheet metal that's under that piece of rubber. A couple of picofarad, which is, if your capacitive, straight capacitance between the base of that antenna through the rubber into the sheet metal has got a capacitive reactance of, let me pick a number, 200 ohms, which under normal circumstances for a quarter wave ground plane where your feed impedance is 35 ohms, 200 ohms of reactance would be very intolerable. But if you're feeding an antenna at the outer end of a half wave resonator, where the impedance is 1,500 or 2,000 ohms, and you've got an extra 200 ohms of reactance to ground, it doesn't count. It's small fish. So sounds like a very nice antenna, and I think it's electronically half-wave, and I wonder if the manufacturer was smart enough to brag about that in his advertisement before you bought it, Alan. What brand name is that? How many dollars? I bet you're pretty happy with it. KC2RFN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I am very happy with it. It's a Comet mobile antenna. I don't remember what I paid. And I have it on a diamond base. So what you're telling me is that because of its characteristics, it is somewhat coupled to the metal, even if it's through the rubber and the chassis. There's enough metal around that even without a direct connection, that's enough to be, quote-unquote, the counterpoise. Or maybe even the chunk of metal that forms the shield into which the coax was screwed into might be enough to counterbalance the antenna. Is that what you're telling me?
You got the idea, Alan. It's very difficult to remove stray capacitance. The base of that antenna and all of that mounting structure has some substantial amount of metal underneath that rubber somewhere. And the sheet metal of your car is another substantial piece of metal nearby. And the two are separated by an eighth of an inch or whatever, what have you. And once you know the physical layout of the metallic objects in the base of the antenna and the physical layout of the sheet metal of your automobile, within about 20% accuracy, you and I, with a little bit of work, could figure out in three dimensions where are the sheet metal, what's the dielectric characteristic of the rubber. Maybe it's got a dielectric constant of 3. In other words, how close are individual pieces of metal, and you can break it up into a whole bunch of little squares and add up all of those capacitances, the straight capacitance. And I think we're going to find out that the straight capacitance probably at 2 meters has a reactance probably well under 100 ohms. And you're feeding a 1,500 ohm antenna because you're feeding the outer edge of a half-wave resonator where the impedance is very high. And if you want to see that as a graph, you can go to the Brown and Woodward curves, which is in every issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook in chapter number 4, chapter number 3 for the very first edition way back in 1980. But after that, it's in chapter number 4. You look at the Brown and Woodward curves, in which every single monopole of any length and any diameter, the resistive component and the reactive component, is on that graph. And you look in there for the resistive component for a half-wave resonator, and you'll see that it's way up there, like 1,500 ohms for any reasonable diameter. And so the straight capacitance is doing it. Let me drop. In the case of the mag mount antennas that many guys put on the top of their car, in order for the magnet not to be scraping the paint, there's a very thin sheet of plastic protecting that magnet so it doesn't make direct contact with the sheet metal of the car. But that straight capacitance is enough of a capacitive reactance that if the manufacturer is smart enough, he can include that capacitive reactance as part of the antenna design, particularly if it's a 5/8 wave antenna or a half wave like yours is. So there are lots and lots of people who misunderstand this concept and think that unless you take a great big round cutting device and drill a real hole through the sheet metal and ground the base of the antenna to the real metal of the car, there are lots of people who think unless you do that, you don't have a good antenna. Well, that's an overly simplistic way of looking at it. If you're smart enough, the straight capacitance can become part of the antenna. And the combination of that straight capacitance and half wave makes it a very easy design. If you did some testing as to how much current is flowing down the outside of the coax cable going back to your antenna, I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised to find it's a very small number and all the radiation is taking place where you want it to, Alan. You can rest easy on this one. KC2RFN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, that does answer a lot, and you read my mind with respect to the magnet mount. My feeling was that the magnet mount, even though it's not directly coupled to the metal of the car, obviously is a very successful antenna design. I'd always assumed that the metal in the magnet was what was acting as the counterpoise. But that never explained why it would act differently when it was on different metal surfaces. So now I understand that both of these designs have taken into account the fact that metal is nearby, and that's good enough at these frequencies and at this power, I imagine. So that answers it perfectly. I appreciate it, Dick.
Hey, Mel, sounds like we got a happy customer on our first one. We'll have to send him a bill. For professional services, for having some fun with you, Alan. Barry, N2 Moonbounce, what's going on in Far Rockaway? And are you shining up that air motor tower periodically? And I know that you're in the process of building a phased array, vertical polarized, 80-meter-like antenna. We'll be looking forward to seeing the results on that. We got the springtime has just occurred. Good antenna building weather. And if I know you, you've been up that tower a couple of times already this year. N2 Moonbounce, K2RIW.
Another comment.
Hal recognized, but Barry first. Go ahead, Barry.
Okay, I'm not going to take up very much time. Yes, I have been working on the antenna, obviously. It won't be long now. We're going to have Moonbounce capability on 6 meters. And I just wanted to make a quick mention of Moonbounce. There's something happening in, I guess it's China. BJ8TA will be on, I got it written down here. He'll be on March 28th to April 1st on 70 centimeters. He doesn't have the best antenna. It's got 29 dB gain. It's a dish, 11-meter dish. He got a kilowatt. And the only thing he didn't do, he doesn't announce his frequency, what frequency he's going to be operating on. However, he does have call letters, thank God. So I'm going to email him during the week, and by next week's net, if anybody wants to know, I will have that information, frequency, and the rest. So there's going to be some activity coming up soon on Moonbounce. It's sad to say I missed the last one. Arecibo was on about a month ago, and I blew it. I did not know about it. That's sad. However, we're working on it. K2RW and 2MB.
You might also try getting a hold of Alan, K2 Uniform Yankee Hotel. For 30 solid years, plus or minus a couple of years, Alan has been publishing a monthly newspaper, lunar monthly newspaper, called the 432 and Above EME News from his center at New Jersey, College of New Jersey, Trenton State College is where he's a professor. And so what a labor of love. And I think there's a 50-50 chance that the latest issue of the 432 EME News might tell you the calling frequency. You probably know that there's a website where you can read all of the past and current issues of the EME News. I wonder if you're aware of that one, Barry. Go ahead.
Yes, I am. And I'm going to let you continue with the net. I just wanted to say that because this is not for your average everyday ham. This guy is not running a lot of power. He's got a 11 minutes, about 28 foot, something like that. And so you kind of have to have a little better than average equipment. But I suspect if you've got 432 equipment at all, you're probably going to hear him. He does have a kilowatt.
Now, I'm a little bit confused by something, Barry. In the old days, a 11-meter dish, which is 35, 34 feet in diameter, that's Alan's dish is only 28 feet in diameter, K2UIH, and a kilowatt into the dish, that combination in the past was a reasonably big gun, where a guy with probably two Yagis that are well-tuned on 432, aimed in the right point in the sky, aimed at the moon at the right time, will, with an ordinary set of ears buried into the earphones, will hear that CW, particularly when the moon is as close to the Earth as it is right now. We're going through a real lunar perigee, which, except for maybe the universe being very noisy behind the moon right now, and you can give me some clues on that one, I think this is a very good time for a person to do a little bit of listening. And I give you a 50-50 chance with a couple of Yagis. Also, if BJ-8... Tango Alpha, and by the way, China is a very rare issue ham radio license to get on moonbounds. The total number of hams in the whole country of China that have ever done moonbounds, I think, is very small. I'm going to pass it back to you in a minute, Barry, for a correction on that. Stand by a second. But that, by my standards, though, that guy's a big gun. And if he goes the next step of using the Joe Taylor techniques, the WSJT techniques, which is a Reed-Solomon chunk of mathematics, you could call it, where you send series of tones by a computer, and the computer listens for those very specific tones and gets the whole alphabet and the numbers, and therefore gets you a message that's about 25 decibels below human hearing, and you still get a good moon-bounce contact out of that. So maybe the guy in China is not equipped for that one yet. And maybe he soon will be. But if he's got an 11-meter dish, if I heard that correctly, and a kilowatt of power into it, kind of curious if it's a parallel kilowatt amplifier. So by way of the EME News from KTUYH, I think you're going to find out more information about this. Thank you for bringing this to our attention, Barry. And to Moonbounce, K2RIW and the TechNet.
Okay, I didn't want to time it out. Okay, yes, I agree with you, but that's what I meant. Most hams in this area, most hams, don't have a couple of Yagis. They've got one, and that's why I said it was going to be marginal for the average guy. Unless you're serious about 432, you might have some trouble hearing him. It's kind of like the way I was phrasing it. And yes, I am going to look up the newsletter, and I certainly will give Al a call this week. I've been meaning to call him anyway, so this is a good excuse. And I'll get back to this net with a bit more information. I suspect a guy with a single Yagi, you know, middle of the road, like 12, 13 elements, something like that, probably will hear him. But if you don't have a lot of power, I don't know if he'll hear you. You got to sort of be up there on the power, I think. It would be advice. Back over to you, N2MB.
Very fine, Barry. On a quick break, Barry, what's your best guess as to the total number of hams in the country of China who have had in the past or have currently moonbounce capability? I suspect it's a very small number. What do you think, Barry?
Yeah, I think that number is 3 at the moment. It used to be 1, but I think right now as we speak tonight, it's about 3. Not too many.
Can you imagine a country with billions of residents and only 3 of them have moonbound capability? That makes it kind of rare. Okay, Hal wanted to make a comment. And let's hope your signal is a little bit stronger than it was before, Hal. K6TPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
RIW TechNet K6DPZ. Yeah, what I wanted to mention was I have seen those half-wave antennas also be driven with a quarter-wave stub so they can be high impedance at one end. They go, they use a coaxial stub, then drive the base of the antenna.
Contact, Victor Echo 7, India Sierra.
Victor Echo 7, India Sierra, recognized. And we've got one other person from outside of the area. Just give us your name and whether or not we should put you on the list of people with a question. There's one person ahead of you. Victor Echo 7, India Sierra. What is your name, sir? K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick.
Hi, thank you very much. We're Canadians working our way north back to Canada. Just looking for Whiskey 7 Hotel Tango Lima. Whiskey 7 Hotel Tango Lima, trying to a node to node with him if possible. So if it's not going to work, you're tied up with a net there. We'll just say good evening from OMAC, Washington. Victor Echo 7 India Sierra, part of a Whiskey 7, over.
Okay, don't think you gave us your name, but yeah, there is a active net on at this time. And it has been for the last 27 years, always on Sunday night on this particular machine. Good luck with meeting up with W7HTL. The next person on our list was Dale, Kilo Juliet 4, Juliet Charlie Papa, if I got it correct, Dale, in Kentucky, one of the DX stations, K2RIW. You got it, Dale.
I've been listening quite a while here, and great to get to talk to you tonight. My question for tonight is all about phases, harnesses. How do they work? How do you calculate them? Two applications that I had in mind is like a 4 or 8 base folded dipole repeater antenna, and also just a phase dipole, like one north-south, other east-west phase together. And that's my question, and I know you guys know. So back to you, Dick. Back to Nipitol.
Very fine, Dave. I mean, Dale. And a little bit of a delay before we heard your voice, but I think we've heard everything you're asking about. Phased arrays or phased harness to feed multiple antennas. And what we're really getting into here is various kinds of interferometry. One of the fancy things about radio antennas is that each antenna has what's called a phase center. In other words, if your eye is operated at radio frequencies and somebody just turned an antenna on, turned on the transmitter, you would see an expanding bubble coming out of the middle of your antenna, whether it be a dipole, a Yagi, or whatever, or a dish, but somewhere in the middle of the antenna, which is called the electronic phase center, you would see a bubble of energy expanding from that point. And if it's a slowed down movie, you would see that bubble coming towards you and getting bigger and bigger in diameter. And in reality, it's moving at the speed of light. But in your slowed down movie, you'd be able to see this. Now, if you've got two antennas side by side, let's assume now I'm building a vertically collinear antenna. In other words, something like a station master antenna that's used for a repeater service. So I've got two separate dipoles collinear with each other. In other words, they're stacked end-to-end, and they're vertically stacked. And if my phasing harness does the right job, let me drop. In my example of the two antenna example, two separate dipoles, and they could be quarter-wave, half-wave, it doesn't matter. If my phasing harness is doing its job correctly, it takes the power out of my transmitter, provides it into two separate connectors, two separate outputs, goes through a power divider or its equivalent, and from that point, as long as the length of cable from the power divider to antenna number one and the length of cable from the power divider to antenna number two, as long as those two lengths of cable are the exact same length, then you are feeding the two antennas in phase. And now in that slow motion movie, you would see a bubble coming out of the phase center of the first antenna. You'd see a bubble coming out of the phase center of the second antenna. Both bubbles would begin at the exact same instant of time. Both bubbles would be expanding, and you're standing off at a long distance where you would suddenly see the two bubbles fold together, fold to each other, and the signal from number one and the signal from number two would hit you at the exact same instant of time. You're standing off to the horizon. And so you're getting a little bit of a feeling how a interferometry antenna works. In the case of that vertical stacked dipole, if I stack enough of those collinear elements, and if I'm smart enough to feed them all in phase, let me drop. As long as I feed them all in phase, and each one has an expanding bubble, but eventually those bubbles fold together into one great big bubble, so to speak, and as you make more and more elements that are vertically stacked, the vertical elevation pattern gets more and more narrow, and eventually becomes what we call a pancake pattern. If I took a fat pancake and lay it parallel to the ground, that is the three-dimensional pattern coming out of that phased array, vertical collinear station master antenna. It's putting very little energy up straight in the air or down toward the ground, but squirting it all out to the horizon and doing it in all 360 degrees in azimuth. And it does that simply because every one of those individual elements are fed in phase and out to the horizon at a long distance. All of those phases add up and all of those bubbles are in phase with each other, if you know what I mean. They're all aiding each other. Now that's a simple vertical collinear. And there's various other ways that you can put four Yagis together into two wide and two high, and a very similar process takes place. So in most cases, the main thing the phasing harness has to do is feed the right amount of power to each antenna. If it's four antennas, usually you're putting one quarter of the power into each antenna, and you're adjusting the lengths of cable to make sure that everyone is fed in the exact same phase. That's if you want the signal to be at right angles to your array of antennas. The next step beyond that, I won't go too deep into it, but if you're now smart enough to intentionally disturb the phases so that some of the antennas are getting the signal a little bit earlier and something a little bit later, now you can electronically steer that beam above the horizon and below the horizon. I won't go in.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I won't go into how you do that, Dale, but take my word for it, it can be done, and that's the next level of understanding of this, electronic steering. And the nice thing about electronic steering is you can do it in a microsecond, where if you're trying to mechanically move the antenna, you'd have a whole lot of trouble moving it in a couple of seconds. But electronically, you can steer an antenna in a microsecond. And, one transmission, you steer a beam that's 10 degrees above the horizon. Another instant of time, you steer the beam 20 degrees above the horizon. Electronically, you can do that. The number of ham radio operators who understand phased arrays is very small. So you're entering a rare group of guys there, Dale. Kilo Juliet 4, Juliet Charlie Papa, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick. You've got it, Dale.
Roger. KJ4JQT, Dale here. I don't hear that much about phases, harnesses, and stuff. Like on a four, take for instance a repeater antenna, a four-bay folded dipole. Your folded dipoles are offset 90 degrees. Are they set up as the collinear type, or are they set up as the next type that you're talking about, where they're all 90 degrees and you're electronically securing each folded dipole? Back to you, Dave.
Yeah, I should have said that one, Dale. Mechanically, you're laying four folded dipoles off to the side of a vertical piece of metal that gives you the mechanical support. Common sense would lead you to believe that vertical piece of metal is a shield in that direction. It's not. Radio-wise, that vertical piece of metal is almost transparent because the effective captured area of each folded dipole is a circle that's half the length of the dipole in diameter. So the circle of effective area of each individual folded dipole is a great big circle that's peeking out behind that vertical pole. So if I had just one folded dipole on the north side of that vertical piece of metal, and I plotted the antenna pattern versus azimuth, the signal would be half a dB weaker to the south, and a half a dB stronger to the north, and equal in power east and west. So there's a very minor amount of shielding. And in order to correct for that, the designer of those antennas, let me drop. In order to correct for that minor factor of a slight amount of shielding of the vertical metal support, he put some of them on the north side, some of them on the south side, some of them on the east side, some of them on the west side. That's a very minor factor. Every one of those is fed in phase. There is no 90-degree shift on the usual way of setting up that collinear with folded dipoles. They're all fed in phase. And the fact that some of them are on the north side and some of them on the south side doesn't matter. At one instant of time, the upper half of each one of those folded dipoles is positive in polarity, and at that exact same instant of time, the bottom of every one of them is negative in polarity. They're all fed in phase. And so there's more than one way to do that, but the one simple way to do it would be a 4-to-1 power divider and equal lengths of cable going to each folded dipole. There's one other catch you can do here, and that is equal length means electronically equal in length. If the two nearest dipoles, it takes me 2 feet of cable to feed them, and if the two outer ones from the center requires a hell of a lot more, I can put a longer piece of cable as long as I add 2 feet plus a multiple of 360 degrees with the velocity factor. So the word in phase might not be the exact same number of feet of cable, but each one of those lengths of cable will differ in length by an integral number of wavelengths with the velocity factor of that cable. When you play this back by listening to the TechNet website, amateurradio.tv, maybe it'll make a little bit more sense. The first time a person hears this, I know it's a little bit crazy, Dale. KJ4JCP, K2RIW. You got it, Dale.
Roger. I see why now very few people know about, because you're getting into some big up here pretty quick. Two more quick questions, and I'll let you continue on here. Steer me to some reading material on phasing harnesses, because I've kind of been fascinated them for a while, and as you hear you say a lot, I'd like to understand them down to the molecular level, which is probably going to really stretch my brain. And also, if I wanted to set up a phase dipole, a east-west one, phase to a north-south one, for me, how would you do that? Back to you, Dick.
Okay, Dale, I'm going to assume you're talking about horizontally polarized dipoles, which means they're all parallel to the Earth, and you've set up one for east-west and one for north-south. And you've got a number of choices here. You could have a separate transmission line going to the east-west dipole. I'll call that transmission line number one, and a separate transmission line going to the north-south. And you bring those two transmission lines into the shack, and you've got a switching arrangement in the shack. And you can decide to transmit on the east-west, or flip the switch and transmit into the north-south. That's a very good way of doing it. The next step beyond that is if you start feeding the dipoles simultaneously with a power divider, and if you fed them both in phase, your east-west and north-south will add together so that you'll have a signal that favors northeast and southwest. And then reverse the phase by adding another half wavelength of cable to one of them, and now you will favor northwest and southeast. That's another way of going. The third way of going is feed one with reference to the other 90 degrees out of phase, an extra quarter wavelength of cable of the east-west versus the north-south. Now you'll be generating circular polarization if you looked at the antenna from the moon down. Let me drop. In other words, top down, you would have circular polarization. But to a person out on the horizon, now you would have a thoroughly omnidirectional dipole. In other words, whether the person is north, northeast, east, southeast, south, and so on, they will all get the exact same amount of signal from your antenna if you set it up with circular polarization. The bottom line of all this is that if you've got two separate dipoles at right angles to each other with two separate feed lines, or it could be two separate driven elements of a Yagi, where some of the elements are horizontally polarized and some of the elements are vertically polarized. But in either case, you've got two separate feed lines and a switching arrangement in the shack. You have complete polarization agility in the case of the Yagi, or in the case of those dipoles, you have complete azimuth angle favoring capability. You can electronically steer the antenna. And by doing that, you'd have a grand old time. And explaining it to the guys on the air as to what you're doing, it'll keep you busy for a long time. You'll be a popular guy there in Kentucky. Over to you, Dale. KJ4JCP, K2RIW. And please come back and tell us how it worked out.
Roger. KJ4JCP, Dale here. Okay, I sure will. That's two projects I've had in mind for a while. Seems like it always, anytime you mention phasing or phasing harnesses, there's always the collinear thing in there. Of course, collinear makes it more or less directional, like you do on CB antennas on a truck, if you have two. I really like the third choice myself. It seems, I'm sure there's downfalls to it, but I really like the circular polarization aspect of it myself. Right off the bat, of course, I'm sure there's downsides to it. Other people are not, some might receive you better than others. Anyway, I really appreciate it. Where could I find out more? Did you say on the TechNet website I might find out more about this? Or do you have any... Can you think of any place that I'll manage to find more read material on saving harnesses? And I really appreciate you answering my question, and I'll turn it back over to you, Dick, and let you continue. K2RIW, this is KJ4JCP, Dale, back to Head Control.
Very fine, Dale. I wish there was a couple of books that really made it nice and simple as to how a phasing harness works. The correct chapter of the ARRL antenna book will help. The correct chapter of the antenna engineering handbook. In the antenna engineering handbook, there are four editions. The early editions were by Henry Jasek. It's a McGraw-Hill book. And the later editions are by, I keep forgetting the guy's name, Volakis, V-O-L-A-K-I-S. But you go to a good technical library, and you look up Antenna Engineering Handbook, an extremely good book. That's the good news. If you want to buy it and own your own copy, it's about $140. Let me drop, I got some more info for you. And when it comes to the east-west dipole and the north-south dipole, if you viewed it top view, when you feed the two a quarter wavelength apart, 90 degrees apart, top view is circular polarized. But to a person on the horizon, he's going to see linear polarization. So it's not quite a circular polarized antenna. However, every azimuth angle will be equal in signal strength. That's either good or bad, depending on how much QRM there is in certain angles. But with that switching arrangement in the shack, you can decide which one to feed, and which one gives you the best signal, but which the best combination for the state of the ionosphere today. Having steering electronic capability is always good. But and the all of the technets for the last 6 years, every single one of them per se, is recorded, and you can play them back on the website www.amateurradio.tangovictor. Amateurradio.tangovictor is the website. And so good luck with that project, and please come back and let us know how it worked out, Dale. Now I'm going to go on to, I presume John's got a quick one between now and 9 o'clock before we pick up with the mailbag. KC2WGB. I wonder if you guys have had a chance to measure any receiver sensitivity yet, John. K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, John. Michael Wilson.
Good evening, Dave. No. What I did was I just sent my Gigatronics generator out for calibration before I do that, so I expect that back by Thursday. So I will be into it probably before the TechNet next week. My question for tonight is, I have a diplexer, and it's used for, as you know, the 70 centimeter 2 meter to a dual band antenna. My question is, can the diplexer be used in reverse for a separating device?
Okay. First of all, I'm not convinced that you really had to send your Gigatronics out for calibration to do a receiver sensitivity test, because before a calibration, if you set it for 1 microvolt and it produces 1.1 microvolt by mistake because it's not in good cal, that's a fraction of a dB of difference, and you don't need that much traceability to the measurement you're about to make to the laboratory, traceable to the Bureau of Standards. Now, almost every single passive device, that includes directional couplers, hybrids, filters, power dividers, almost everything that's thoroughly passive is, by definition, obeying the law of reciprocity. That means if you put the signal into terminal number 1 and you take the signal out of terminal number 2 and you get a certain response, and if you reverse the process, put the signal into 2 and take it out of number 1, they got to work identically in both directions. So can a diplexing filter be used as a frequency summer? Absolutely. In other words, I could have a kind of diplexing filter which has a common port where it separates, internally, it separates what comes into the common port and puts the 70 centimeter signal out of port number 2 and the 2 meter signal out of port number 3. I can easily do that with a kind of diplexing filter. Then I can feed it backwards if I want to. I can take a 2 meter transmitter, connect it to port number 3, a 70 centimeter transmitter, connect it to port number 2, take the common port and connect it to an antenna that operates on those two bands. And I'm now feeding it backwards. So almost every passive device obeys reciprocity. They work identically in the two directions. Life gets a little bit more complicated when you use that idea with a mixer, because a mixer requires a local oscillator, and you may think it's passive because you're not putting a power supply connected to it, but a mixer really is an active device. It's got a kind of nonlinearity. Things that have linear inductors, capacitors, and resistors will obey reciprocity. I can take my Wilkinson power divider, and if I'm smart enough, I can feed it backwards as a power summer, and it'll work like a charm and have the exact same insertion loss if I'm smart enough to set up the phases correctly on the two signals that I'm summing. Maybe that helps, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, perfect answer, Dick. Exactly what I wanted to hear. I thought so, but I wasn't sure. And by the way, the Gigatronics was out of calibration by 5 months anyway. It was due, so I had to have it done anyway. But thanks for answering my question, and I'll talk to you down the line.
Now, I'm going to let you in on a funny secret. One of the laboratories that I work in has a beautiful vector network analyzer made by Roden Schwartz. And Roden Schwartz did such a beautiful job of designing that particular vector network analyzer that I can turn it off today, turn it back on tomorrow, and it acts like I calibrated it 30 seconds ago. It comes back to life exactly the way I left it. I could turn it off for a day or a week, or I can let it play continuously for a month. Boy, does that thing hold its cal. The Hewlett-Packard one or the Agilent one doesn't do that, but the one made by Rohde & Schwarz does. As such, I've discovered that many of the pieces of test equipment in that particular laboratory that we used to send out for Cal, what the Cal company was really doing is cleaning up the air filters, going through a Cal procedure, and handing us back a machine that was not behaving the same way as we sent it out. Quite often it came back worse than it went out. As such, on that particular instrument that we do not use for production testing, we're only using it for development hardware. As such, the calibration is not commanded by the commercial rules or the military rules. It's not used for production testing. Therefore, we have not sent it out for calibration for multiple years. Therefore, nothing changes. We've got control of it, and it solves the problem beautifully. I have used Gigatronics signal generators for a number of years on the B-1B bomber program while working for another company. And as long as you don't drop it on the floor, and as long as you don't do something really weird, that is a slightly heavy but very rugged piece of instrumentation. I don't think that thing will ever go out of Cal unless you abuse the living daylights out of it, or unless you just happen to get a lemon, and there's very few lemons made by Gigatronics. So,
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
So in my opinion, Paul, John, you don't have to cal that. You could save yourself some money, and as long as you're not doing production testing where you have to guarantee the results traceable to the National Bureau of Standards, as long as you're not doing production testing or military delivery, I'm not convinced you got to cal that unless you know of some kind of an error that's beyond which you could repair. And once you've got the service manual on that machine, which is a very well-written manual, I think 90% of any of the things that ever go wrong, like a slipping knob or a broken fuse or whatever, you could fix. So you could save yourself some money if you wanted to. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
ZEA.
You know, Dick, I'm sure you feel the same way about your equipment. I wrapped that with bubble wrap and all kinds of styrofoam in a box about twice the size of the unit. And I had UPS pick it up. And, you know, I walked it out to the front. He took it, and he just heaved it into the truck. I got sick. It was like putting a child on a school bus for the first time. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I've heard a ZEA sign in. We'll pick you up in a second. Yeah, part of what happened with the calibration that used to take place at the other company I worked at is that the calibration was taking place within the company, but at another building in another town. They literally would take all of these delicate pieces of instrumentation, put it on a flatbed truck with no padding of any kind, bounce it down the road from point A to point B, supposedly do a calibration, put it back on the flatbed truck, and bounce it on that road again back to us. And one-third of the time, we received an instrument that was in considerably worse shape than when we shipped it out. But it had a brand-new Cal sticker on it, and therefore when the inspectors came around from the military facilities, they saw the update date Cal sticker and they were happy. And so it was a system that really wasn't working. And so to defend myself in the current situation, on a particular instrument which is not being used for production testing, no Cal is taking place. And it puts us way ahead of the game. And I've had lots of years of use out of that machine every single day, and it has never hiccuped up on me once. And the once or twice it made an error, it was pilot error, if you know what I mean. Okay, Mr. ZEA, I think it is. Give me your full set of call letters and your name, sir, if you're signing in with a question. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, Dick. November 2, Z Echo Alpha. The name is Glenn.
Go right ahead, Glenn. November 2, Zulu Echo Alpha.
I just want to get on the list for questions. Am I next?
You've just bubbled up to the top of the list, Glenn. You're number one on the runway.
Excellent. Two questions. One is a simple one. Right at the block committee, installed a new traffic system, and there's two lights that have Yagis pointing at each other. And I was wondering if it's possible to listen to how they talk to each other. And the second question is on the nuke station in Japan. and maybe what you can enlighten everybody on and maybe talk about it.
Okay. When it comes to the nuclear power station in Japan, I don't know anything more than anyone else who's watching the news. I'm not a nuclear engineer, so I've got nothing to contribute on that one. A little bit of understanding of where the thermal runaway is coming from and what everyone's worried about, but I've got nothing to contribute on that one. When it comes to traffic lights, in my neighborhood, Glenn, many of the traffic lights have a infrared sensing system where the law enforcement and fire department is able to send out a very characteristic coded signal so that when they need to get through the traffic light, they can command it to be green in their particular direction as they approach the traffic light, and they don't have to sit there and wait in traffic for the light to turn from red to green while somebody is dying somewhere else, if you know what I mean. So with infrared signaling, they have control of those traffic lights. I can see the possibility that in some communities, maybe that control could take place on an RF frequency, and with those Yagi antennas, maybe that's what's taking place. I wonder if there's also just that's a convenient place to do some communicating, and so a Yagi antenna was placed there. So I don't know. Let me pass it over to the net. If anyone has ever seen or knows about Yagi antennas on traffic lights and what are they doing there, please give us your call letters right now, K2RIW and the TechNet.
KC2YDT, I think I have an answer to a little bit of that question.
KC2YDT, go right ahead, Matt, and tell us what you know about it.
Okay, when it comes to changing the traffic lights, they have them set up now where, you know, the emergency services cars have a special white strobe light in the car, and almost like a radar, the light will pick up that strobe light is flashing, and then only in that direction will the light be green, and the rest will be red. I don't know if that was the answer, but that's what I know. KC2YDT, that's the answer.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And that way you can select the direction that turns green for the emergency traffic. And I am guessing that that flashing white light, in your case, is doing it with a very specific code, a very specific protocol, so that just not any flashing would do it. Very similar to the remote controls that we're using for our television sets and our VCRs and whatever, our Blu-ray machines. Put out a very specific code for each one of the buttons you press. And so the traffic light, I think, is doing that. But it's beginning to look like, Glenn, we don't have a great deal of information for your particular case. And either one of your questions looks like you've stumped this particular group that's gathered here tonight. N2 Zulu Echo Alpha, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay. If I wanted to put some kind of receiver out there and possibly listen to whatever's getting transmitted out of Yagi, what would be the best way to approach that?
Okay. Find out what brand name of electronics was connected to that traffic light and talk to that company and ask them if they'll tell you the frequencies. Probably they will not. The next best thing you could do is make a guess as to when communication takes place, and by way of a scanner or spectrum analyzer, and you sitting nearby, sweep it until you hear the signal coming from it. And I'll admit that that's not easy. So quite often, services like the one I think you're describing consider the frequencies of operation proprietary, and they're afraid to release them for fear that somebody's going to start jamming their particular service. Not quite sure what interesting signals you're going to hear, but to try to find out what frequencies it transmits, the best you could do is that by various techniques of optics, you can measure the lengths of the individual elements of the Yagi. Almost all Yagis have a driven element that's very close to a half wavelength long. The reflector is a little bit longer than a half wavelength by about 5%, and the directors are a little bit shorter than a half wavelength by about 5%. By the physical dimensions of the elements of the Yagi, with about 5% accuracy, you will know what frequency it was designed for. that drastically narrows your range of search frequencies to try to find out what frequency it's on. Because with rare exception, a Yagi has a rather narrow bandwidth unless it's a very special design.